Awesome. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
Yeah, a little tired, from staying up for the Super Bowl, but worth it.
Yeah, what time is it over there for, when you when the game was on? How late was that?
Usually starts at like midnight 30, so 30 minutes to one,
Oh,
and then the
man.
game usually ends around like 4 a.m., 5 a.m.
Damn, that's a very long night.
Yeah, but it's well worth it. I mean, diverting from our usual fight topics, I guess the football gods really kind of punished Patriots fans last night by showing that it was well worth to pay a little bit of money for Tom, I guess, if he's putting on performances like that at 43. So it was great to watch.
Oh, definitely. But too, like he did a recent interview that I really liked, where he had talked about just simply like the biggest deciding factor for him in leaving was just that at 43 he wasn't playing as well in the cold,
Yeah.
and so he just wanted to go somewhere warmer. And so I respect the hell out of that. Because also too, like his last two seasons with the Patriots, he wasn't really doing very well. You
Yeah.
know, like the Super Bowl they won against the Rams, they did it almost in spite of Tom. And then with it, and then last season they just, at least the 2019 one, I think it was just at best intensely mediocre, but like the performance really slipping. And the Patriots also showed that they weren't doing a great job at giving him the tools he needs. I mean, the Buccaneers, they put together a great team this year,
Yeah, this is
and
like a
it
one and
obviously
done team, right? It's kind of like they went in the offseason and they just picked up guys on cheap contracts and just try to throw together like a Super Bowl contender for 1 year in hopes that maybe this year they can re-sign some of those same guys. But like you look at that offense, Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, Braid, Gronkowski, Antonio Brown. Like I don't think there's a single team in the league that has that many offensive weapons. And the defense also looked spectacular yesterday. So Bruce Arians really put together like one hell of a squad in the offseason.
Oh, absolutely. And it also made me really wish that the Patriots had kept Antonio Brown for more than a week.
Yeah.
It's like, sure, the guy's a shithead, but God damn it, is he good at
Yeah, the 1 year he's scandal free
it.
is the 1 year that he wins a Super Bowl with Tom and the guys. So,
Yeah.
I mean, it was good to watch. I think it's cool watching Gronk and him win, and especially connecting like for touchdowns in the Super Bowl and showing that the fire is still there for both of them. So, pretty awesome.
Absolutely. And I know there are a lot of Patriots fans who are, unhappy that like to see Brady do so well. But honestly, like, and I think this is in part that I've always been much more of a fan of combat sports over regular ones,
Yeah.
that I frankly, like, I it's much easier for me to root for an individual over a team. Because
Exactly.
also too, like, it just really doesn't mean a whole lot to me to have a team happen to play near my house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, none of them are like, I am a Patriots fan. I always have been, but none of them are from New England. I mean, Tom Brady himself is from California.
In
Like, it
Fresno.
would mean a lot more to me if they did it. For instance, like, I know the German football teams. I'm pretty sure there's a rule where half the roster has to be from Germany.
Exactly,
Like,
yeah,
and
they
I'd
have
be
some
much
sort of
more.
a
Exactly, yeah, because I have actually my friend Zach plays quarterback professionally for a team out there. And my friend Mike Malvesti used to be a safety, and he had told me all about it. And that would make me more invested if I knew that, like, okay, well, our region makes the best players. It's like, no,
exactly.
we have a good bankroll. We were able to have, a good eye for talent and all that.
Yeah.
And it's like, because I mean, the reality is just because they happen to play near me, that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, I have only a slightly better chance of meeting Tom Brady than I do the fucking Avengers. And so,
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
why do I care?
I mean, I was born and raised in Massachusetts, man, and I'm telling you, the only time I ever saw Tom Brady was at the Pan Mass Challenge, and he rode his bike for about like 15 minutes in the distance, and I couldn't even really see I didn't even meet him. I saw him from like 50 yards away, riding his bike. So it's a good point.
Oh, exactly. So, like, aside from the duck boat parade, who the hell cares?
Yeah.
And, but that said, I also, like, to any of my friends who are going to listen to this, I completely understand that I'm in the minority here.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but I agree with you. Anyways, segueing into the fights, I guess it was a pretty stacked card. Was a bit sad to see Mike lose in that first fight, but it's always fun to watch him.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and honestly, too, like that guy, you know, what's his name? Danilo Marquez. Marquez just had the perfect game plan for him. Just, you know, the relentless grappling. And I mean, you know, I love Mike. I trained with him a lot for a good period of time. And, man, that's just like, if there's a way to fight him, that's how to do it. Like just the relentless pressure. You know, because, like, while Mike was doing a great job defending, you can only do it for, you know, it's really hard to do that and mount an offense.
Yeah.
And so then when Mike started to let go a little bit, because you have to if you intend to win. It's not enough to just not lose. You have to win.
Exactly.
You know, it's like that then left him open to, you know, to then, you know, kind of get beaten. And so it sucks. I feel really bad for him. And but I mean, honestly, I think Mike has looked better in every fight that he's had. And I think from a stylistic standpoint, it's not going to get any worse than Danilo Marquez. And I think there are so many guys at 205 that Mike would do very well against.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing that in the future.
Exactly. I mean, like a lot of these guys, they build the best with like that high level pressure. And obviously it's easy for you to go to local shows and kind of, we all know how the scene works, right? It's not everyone that wants to fight everybody. And it's a lot of waiting around, but now that you have like more action and he's got the opportunity to kind of experience high level, win at a high level, he's always going to improve at a high level as well. So it's going to be great to see.
Oh, exactly. I mean, like, I'd love to see him fight a guy like a Khalil Roundtree or some, you know, a guy who will kind of play at that kickboxing range. I think Mike is absolutely devastating there, and I think he could really do some damage.
100%, man. Otherwise, it was a great fight. The next fight, I think this is kind of like a lightweight dark horse fight in terms of how the division is moving, because obviously everyone knows about Ferguson and Gaethje and Mike Chandler and all these other guys, but Carlos Ferreira versus Beneil Dariush, sick fight. I think Dariush is on a 5-fight win streak now, or 6-fight win streak after that.
Yep.
And Diego or Carlos Ferreira coming off the win off of Anthony Pettis, I believe. So these guys are legit, dude. And Beneil's a savage, bro. That fight against Dracar Close we had last year with that come from behind knockout, the spinning back fist of Scott Holtzman. Like, I think he's a real sleeper. He's 24-1. And obviously training out of Kings MMA is getting some sick training over there. So I wouldn't be surprised if he starts fighting some guys in the top five now.
Well, that's what he's really been calling for a lot. But it is just a testament to how deep the UFC's rosters have become in some of these divisions, that you can have a guy who's like 24-1 and on a 5-fight winning streak and have it barely crack the top 10.
Yeah.
You know, because like, I remember, you know, way back when people were saying that Max Holloway was being robbed because he had like, he was on like a 6-fight win streak and hadn't gotten a title shot.
Yeah.
Now, not only is that,
he was like 8 or 9 or something. He was on a huge fight streak.
Was it?
Yeah, he
was. But I remember it like being like as much as 6, where they were really like, he needs a title shot.
Yeah.
And but now, like, you know, Beneil Dariush is having, you know, having that, and he's barely in the top 10, you know, nobody's talking about wanting to see him against Tony Ferguson or your Charles Oliveira or any of these top guys. And he, you know, and so like, well, I feel for him because he's 100% deserving of it. He's a clearly incredible, you know, both of them are clearly incredibly talented and I think would do well, you know, in the mix. It's like, it takes so much to earn that now, to get that bump, especially when you do have, you know, like we're seeing Dustin and Connor likely doing a trilogy fight. You have, you know, rematches and sort of like people sitting around waiting for title shots and just like all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe Khabib is sticking around, but fighting GSP. Like there's so many like things going on in the back room that we hear rumors of that makes it really difficult for, you know, contenders who are just trying to break in.
100%. What do you think about like the lightweight holdout, like Dustin Poirier essentially saying that like he's not going to fight Mike Chandler at all, essentially because he hasn't just like worked his way like the rest of the lightweights have and put in that work, paid in full, he says.
So that is kind of a tricky standoff. Like I would rather see Chandler fight Gaethje and then Oliveira fight Dustin for the title. And if they want to have Conor do something, have him fight Nate again. But I think ultimately Dustin's a company man, and I get that he's publicly saying that, but I'm sure if gun to head, if it really came down to it, he would accept that fight.
Yeah.
But I do think Chandler should get in line. You know, I mean, obviously he looked very good against Dan Hooker. You know, that was, you know, a very, very good performance. And I think Chandler is certainly, you know, at the level of them, but like there, you know, you do kind of have to pay your dues.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, so I would love to see how he does against Gaethje, you know, that's basically where I stand. And honestly, part of me does still think that we'll see Dustin Conor 3.
I think we will see Dustin Conor 3. And I think both of them have kind of agreed for the trilogy. And I think both of them know that obviously like each of them finishing each other kind of shows that they are kind of at a standstill in terms of like who will win on any given day, which obviously I think these guys could fight 10 times in one night and we'd have no idea who would win each fight. And I think it's the most compelling matchup to make. And if Conor is actually serious about fighting and like being consistent, like the way he says he is, especially in his post-fight interview, saying it's just a lack of being in there and kind of just getting in that rhythm, then maybe we do see that trilogy fight sometime in the summer or something, or like a big blockbuster card they probably do in Dubai again. But I think that the dues do have to be paid. But then again, we are talking about a guy in Mike Chandler that's fought everybody in Bellator and fought in Ryzen, and he's beaten former champs and Eddie Alvarez and stuff like that. And I think I understand where Dustin's coming from, and I think that it's a bit frustrating for him, right? Because I think in his mind, he should be the lightweight champion now. And why should he kind of be fighting some no-name when we have contenders like Oliveira and Gaethje and all of them having common losses, and Khabib that, I mean, it doesn't necessarily knock them off that top five and necessarily mean that they shouldn't get a title shot, right? So I understand.
Agreed. You know, because, it is kind of a tough position where
– yeah.
You know, you diehards like you and I know how good Chandler is,
yeah.
But nobody else really cares. And so, like, if Dustin beats him, you know, yeah, it'll look really good, but, you know, to the casual, maybe not so much. But that, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think ultimately, like, if it's, you know, for the belt, I think Chandler deserves it. I mean, Oliveira certainly does too. I think it would be a bigger fight to have it be Chandler versus Dustin.
Yeah.
As you know, Chandler has a lot of heat right now, and so does Dustin. And while Oliveira is very, very talented and has been doing tremendous work, I feel like he's been more kind of low-key about it. Because he also, too, well, yes, he dominated Tony Ferguson. Like, absolutely dominated him. Ferguson, at this point, as far as I can tell, he almost seems shot now. Like, you know, like he hasn't even fully recovered from the Gaethje fight.
Yeah.
And so who's to say what that even really means until we see Tony win again?
Sure. I think Gaethje was also saying like he doesn't even necessarily think that Tony Ferguson was always like a top dog. He just kind of really, I don't know, matched up well. And it was kind of like not handpicked, but like up until he really reached that like pinnacle of top five lightweights and actually fighting those guys. Because, okay, he put on some impressive performances against a lot of guys that were good, right? But he wasn't always necessarily, like a contender in the top five. He just matched up really well, and that one kind of got in there with the big dogs. He's been exposed, essentially.
I do think, like, there's an old truth to that. But I also think because of the nature of MMA, you can easily frame somebody or make somebody like you can put somebody over or make them look like crap.
Yeah.
You know, like for instance, take what we were saying about Mike.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you could, if you wanted, you know, if, you know, he was getting a good push to put him over, they put him against guys who were just going to strike with him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so it's like, you can also have them look, you know, not as great fighting guys who are just going to grapple.
Sure.
That goes against them. You know, like look at their treatment of Conor McGregor when he was coming up. Because sure, in hindsight, we saw he beat killers because he fought guys like Max Holloway and Dustin Poirier. But we didn't know they were killers at the time. They sure. were just guys who matched up favorably with what Conor does. If they, you know, if they didn't care about Conor or just treat him like another guy on the roster, then they'd be like, cool, you're going to fight Chad Mendez, and then you're going to fight Frankie Edgar. And then you're going to fight, like, you know, all these guys are just going to drag him to the ground and hold him.
Yeah.
And so, like, were they necessarily trying, you know, so I don't know, because I think there's bad matchups for everybody.
Tough to say, right?
I think Ferguson, exactly. I think Ferguson has dealt with a ton of injuries, you know, has been in a lot of wars, puts himself through hell, because the guy, if the rumors are true, is an actual schizophrenic.
And trains like a psychopath.
Exactly. I would say, especially based on what I know about, like, his training regimen and, like, what I know, like, in my job as a strength coach, that, like, he's just put his body through hell. And I guarantee you has not done what he needs to recover. And it's just sort of part of what makes him good, because he's such a psycho.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I think that's kind of like an easy thing for Justin to say.
Yeah.
Because hindsight means that, you know, hindsight's everything. I don't think that he was trying to put him over by any standard.
Sure.
I think they largely, because I think the UFC viewed him as largely a, for a very long time, up until, like, you know, or up until the time that they first started talking about him fighting Khabib. I think he was just viewed as an exciting guy to put in the middle of the card who would, you know, do really well, could hang with the top 10. But, you know, I don't think they ever viewed him as being somebody who was going to be the guy.
Yeah.
But then he just kept getting wins. And then that was when the excitement really built over Tony Ferguson. And so I don't know if Gaethje really knows what he's talking about there.
Yeah, I think, like, maybe just talking.
Yeah, you can kind of say it. But...
just talking shit after.
Exactly, because, I mean, again, exactly. This is all about hindsight. You know, because again, it's easy in hindsight to look at, like, Conor McGregor's resume and say he fought killers. But at the time, you know, we didn't know Max Holloway was a killer. We didn't know Dustin Poirier was.
Yeah.
Like, and so, enough. Yeah, the same can be true for Tony. If it turns out that he had an easier resume than you maybe thought he did, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, like we mentioned, the lightweight divisions, it's mixed up, man. But I actually think the next fight that came up in the card was like a complete dark horse flyweight matchup, because, like, a lot of people don't know who Manel Capé is at all. And I don't think a lot of people know what leagues have competitive flyweight divisions outside of the UFC, because Bellator doesn't have one. And you'd have to look mostly at ONE FC and Ryzen, right? So Manel Capé being the Ryzen flyweight champ, you beat guys like Ian McCall, who was a contender in the UFC, and he was literally the face of the flyweight division for a very long time, especially when they created that division. Yep. It almost seemed like it was molded for Ian McCall. So he's a guy coming off of title run over there at Ryzen, and Alexandre Pantoja is the only guy, I think, in the UFC, I might be wrong, that holds a victory over Davison Figueiredo.
Yeah, I mean, I think hit the nail on the head. I mean, it really was a dark horse. And we are seeing too just how talented, you know, really the other promotions are in general.
Yeah.
Because, like, it is one of those things where, you know, this fits with what we were talking about with Chandler as well, that it's viewed as, you know, the UFC's up here and then everybody else is way the hell down there.
Yeah.
And while those other promotions may not have the depth that the UFC does, the top guys are generally, you know, just as good as the guys in the, you know, in the UFC.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Chandler is 100% has the talent to be a guy in the UFC.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why, like, I wouldn't be upset if he got a title shot right away.
Yeah,
and the same can be said for Ryzen, for ONE FC. And we even saw it when, when Eddie Alvarez went over FC and then immediately lost.
Yeah.
You know? It's like they're just as good over there.
Yeah, man, I agree with you 100%. It was nice to see Alexandre pick up the win. I think it was a real back and forth fight. Excited to see both those guys in the octagon again. And I would assume that this kind of lines Alexandre up. I think after the Moreno Davison Figueiredo rematch, we probably see a guy like Pantoja maybe fight one more time. And if he wins, fight for the title. And I think he's actually been projected from a lot of analysts to maybe even be the champion by the end of the year. So let's see. Yeah, and then the next fight of the night, we had two vets step in there. We got Clay Guida and Michael Johnson. Clay Guida come out with a W. I thought Guida looked good for a man of his age. What is he, 40 now? 40s?
Yeah, I think he's either 39 and, like, about to turn 40 soon, or he just turned 40. One or the other.
Yeah, but I don't know.
I thought they both looked decent. You know, yeah. I thought I think Michael Johnson, at this point, he's getting the BJ Penn numbers where I think he's like 2-9 in his last 11 or something like that. Like, yeah. Just something ridiculous. But Guida did look really good. He looked like the Guida of old. And like, I don't know if he has it to face like a 21-year-old prospect in spite of what I know he specifically called for that.
Yeah.
but I don't know. It's interesting to see like where a guy like him goes now.
Yeah, I mean, he looked really crafty on his feet, and obviously he always like relies on the wrestling when he needs to, especially when he feels rocked. And I think we saw that because obviously Michael Johnson does pack a big punch. But I mean, the guy's 20-17, like you said, he's hitting that BJ Penn number where he's almost break even in 40 fights, which is absolutely nuts. But I don't know what it is, because I mean, Michael Johnson's talented. If you look at the list of guys that he's beat, like and come close to beating, like he has what it takes to like really have been like a top five lightweight. But it's tough to say like what he's going through as far as injuries or training camp, that he just doesn't deliver when it comes fight time.
I mean, I think that I'm basing this entirely on what the commentating team was saying during his fight, where he had said he's committing himself by living more professionally and all that. I wonder if he just kind of blew his opportunity by partying too much and all that. So, and that led to just big inconsistencies. Because, yeah, I mean, he has wins over, you know, guys like Dustin Poirier, I think Justin Gaethje. Doesn't he have a win over Tony too?
Yeah, he's got a win over Tony. He's got a win over Poirier. Gaethje, he lost in Gaethje's debut.
But he
rocked the shit out of Gaethje on multiple occasions. And arguably, everyone says that Michael Johnson's the only person to ever rock Khabib in a fight. So
yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that's the thing. He's hung in there with, you know, even the ones he lost to, he's hung in there with the very best. You know, though I do remember the Khabib fight was the one where Khabib famously looked over at Dana while he was beating up Johnson. It was like, you know, I really deserve the title shot at this point.
Yeah.
And be like, I don't want to keep doing this to you. And all that. Like,
you have to give up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I don't want to keep beating you.
Yeah.
But yeah. And so who knows? I mean, he's definitely incredibly inconsistent. He either looks great or very bad. I thought he looked good and still lost. But, you know, in spite of him looking good, you know, it's like he definitely like seemed to be like kind of tripping over some of his punches, but he always kind of does that. Like, he's a very front leaning guy. He's heavy on his lead foot. So sometimes he'll look a little sloppier than I feel like he is.
Yeah.
But I you know, overall, I thought he looked decent.
Yeah, I thought they both looked decent, but still, I guess it's probably Michael Johnson's end of the road with the UFC, like you mentioned. And now that they're doing all these big roster cuts, I wouldn't be surprised if Johnson's the next one to go. And I think that was kind of fighting for your career at that point. I think that's end of the road for Michael Johnson, which is sad. I mean, he was a huge prospect coming off of the Ultimate Fighter and had a lot of promise, but never seemed to really put things together. He comes out of a sick camp, right? He was training with the Blackzillas, and
yeah,
I've seen some of his gym footage. I mean, you can never compare gym footage to an actual fight, but the guys in there going toe to toe with Kamaru Usman and all these other monsters in that gym, and seems to be standing his ground and doing well. So it's shit to say, but end of the road for him. Clay Guida looked great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, maybe because of Johnson's like, you know, history, maybe they will like get kind of give him another shot.
Yeah.
But at this point, I mean, I think he does probably need to evaluate some things.
Yeah.
And, you know, and honestly too, maybe even like if I'm Sean Shelby and Dana White, I would want him to come at me with a plan as to, and a reason as to why they should keep him.
Yeah.
Because exactly. They also don't want to see anybody just keep getting beat up in there.
Exactly.
Like, and so maybe if he could give him like some evidence as to why he at least believes he's going to turn it around, then that would be enough to keep him.
Yeah, 100%. The next fight was sick. I mean, I know you have high praises on Corey Sandhagen. The guy's an absolute monster, and he's always looking for a finish. And I think he's just one of these kind of like who used to call it? I think it's Eddie Bravo, like a nerd assassin. Like you can tell he's just like like a very smart guy, like IQ, like very smart, fight IQ, very smart, but like a really hard worker. And I think that this is kind of like the best mix for a mixed martial artist, a guy who's really just kind of like intellectually very smart, athletically very gifted. I think this is where Corey Sandhagen falls in. And I think the guy's an absolute beast.
Oh, 100%. I don't know if I was more happy for him or more sad for Frankie Edgar.
Yeah.
But just his timing on that knee was terrific. He just completely, you know, Frankie came out and did what he always does, and Corey lulled him in, and then just boom, that was it.
Yeah, the fight was super quick. I was honestly shocked.
Did he throw any other strikes other than the knee?
I think there was a couple leg kicks in there.
It was just, you know, and I know the commentating team kind of broke it down afterwards, but he did, like, he kind of pulled him in, and then just that flying knee was lethal. It was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to see that Frankie's competed in 3 weight classes now, and his most successful has been at his most heavyweight class, where he kind of walks around naturally and maybe even has to bulk up a little bit. And to be fair, I think at 155, he was doing great, like had a couple like skid losses, like nothing that bad. But once he dropped down to 45 and 35, he just couldn't seem to keep up with the speed of these guys, especially being a smaller guy. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, too, like, I thought his speed looked good, unfortunately, it didn't help him out too much, but, like, yeah. You know, he looked like he was moving well and stuff like that, but he just, once your durability goes, that's a problem.
I mean, he's been a world, right?
And now who's to say, exactly, I mean, like, the Gray Maynard ones, the Benson Henderson ones, like, he's just, like, you know, he was known as the guy who would get the hell kicked out of him and then rally and come back.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, that check still needs to, you know, be cashed at some point. You know what
exactly.
I mean? And it's like, and I think this is where we're starting to kind of see the issues with that.
Yeah. I mean,
but also too, he's 39.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, for a young fighter, you know, it's like, not a young fighter, for the lighter fighters, like 39 is very old.
Yeah.
It's one, you know, it's normal to see heavyweights fight in their 40s, but for the lighter guys like him and even Clay Guida, it's very unusual to see a lighter guy fight that old. You know, usually their window is much shorter.
Yeah, for sure. And I thought Frankie looked really good in the Pedro Munhoz fight in his bantamweight debut. And like, I was expecting a little bit more of a fight coming into this, but I think over the course of time, we've kind of seen just like his durability and his chin go, like you mentioned. I mean, like you said, the wars with Benson and then the wars with Gray Maynard, the wars with Jose Aldo, we always forget about. And
Yeah.
And I think you've seen like, there's kind of a trend, like he got knocked out by Ortega for the first time. Then he got knocked out by the Korean Zombie. And now he's taking the loss on the chin again against Corey Sandhagen. I mean, props to Sandhagen. That flying knee was absolutely nasty. And it was like a walk-off flying knee. Like it was that kind of nasty to see in slow motion. Like Frankie kind of like actually land on his feet after the knee hit him and just kind of like topple over like a pile of dominoes. Dude, it was nuts to watch.
Absolutely.
Main event.
Absolutely.
Pretty slick also. Overeem and Volkov. I mean, obviously these guys were scheduled to fight in Moscow before. I think it was kind of inevitable that these guys would fight anyways because they're two guys that like to stand and trade. But I think Alistair came out with just the wrong game plan against a guy like Volkov. I think Alistair is good on the ground. He has good submissions. He's heavy. He's got nasty ground and pound. We saw that in some of his older fights and most recent fights. And Volkov obviously doesn't really offer much of defense on the ground. We saw that in the Curtis Blaydes fight. There was almost no resistance. So I didn't understand why Alistair was up trading with him, but Volkov put on a sick performance.
So to me, what it looked like, and I had actually been slightly favoring Overeem because I figured he was going to be aggressively trying to grapple.
Yeah.
And, because I do think of the two, he's the better grappler, you know, because he's shown that, you know, he can be smart and he can be technical. And Volkov is kind of a one-trick pony. Like, his grappling isn't necessarily bad, but he just, he's also not really a power striker. He generally beats it with volume. And while Overeem's always been kind of chinny, I figured if he was aggressively looking at taking that grappling range, that would kind of take away Volkov's ability to really do much, especially with him being the longer fighter. So Overeem needed to kind of stay in his face. But to me, it looked like he took that first punch, you know, kind of like snapped out really quick. And it just seemed to get so deep in Overeem's head that from there, he just kept shelling up and doing nothing. Like, it was to the point where I couldn't tell how he was trying to win.
Yeah, 100%. I think we've seen this a couple of times in Overeem fights where he's kind of like in his own head. And I think that maybe the pressure of this being his last title run kind of got to him, right? Like you said, when he got snapped with that first exchange, you kind of just see the motivation just sucked out of Overeem. And there's not much he could have really done after that, especially when he's got his back up against the cage and we've seen him do it before. And he just kind of like high guards it, like fists on his head and just taking punishment.
And honestly, for MMA, I hate that in general, because it's just like your opponent knows you can't counter quickly. So he can just kind of tee off. And unlike when you're wearing boxing gloves, you just can't really shield yourself very much with those little MMA gloves. So you're just, leaving yourself open to get the shit kicked out of you.
Yeah.
And, and that was probably the most confident we've ever seen Volkov, and for that reason. You know, he just, he had Overeem on his heels the whole time. And so Volkov was just really able to open up on him. And, so props to Volkov. He looked really good. But Overeem also just really didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know how much. Yeah. And this is a... Unfortunately, what we saw the whole night is the veterans losing to the, to the younger, more, prospects of more of their careers in front of them. And so I think the three guys we talked about of Johnson, Edgar, and Overeem, and I hate to say it, because especially in the case of Overeem and Edgar, who are legends of the sport at this point, I think it's probably time to hang it up. Because at this point, it's like, why are you doing it? Edgar, I think at this point, it kind of proved in both the fights, between the fights of Munoz and Sanhagen, it's like he's not going to be the guy. He kind of got beat up and outclassed against Pedro Munoz, and then he got knocked out quick by Sanhagen. And so it's like, what's he expecting to do to TJ Dillashaw or to Cody Garbrandt or to order Rob Font or any of the other killers in the division? It's just not going to happen. If he wants to just fight Uriah Faber again, cool, I'd be for that. But if he just wants to try and get a W before he leaves, but if he's not going to retire, not fight the 24-year-olds who are who are projected to be champion later, like Corey Sandhagen.
Yeah, 100%. I couldn't agree more with you. I think eventually you reach a point where it's either you have to start fighting in promotions, sad to say, with less competition if you're doing it to kind of substantiate your income. But if you're set and the only reason you're fighting is really to just kind of prove something to yourself. I can understand that's a noble cause, right? That Frankie wants to prove to himself and to everyone else that he can be a champion again in the UFC. But at 39, I guess it's a tough bid. Like when you said, when you're fighting a lot of killers like Sanhagen and Garbrandt and Dillashaw and Peter Yan, and we can just name on and on and on, Aljamain Sterling, Rob Font, all these guys. I don't know how he would fare against the top five. I don't think he beats any of those guys, to be quite frank. And I think the same goes for Overeem. and Volkov. I think it was a good fight. It was a nice, it was a nice main event. And I think that, like, we all love watching heavyweights fight, but I don't think Volkov or Overeem fared well at all with any of the guys in the top five of the heavyweight division. So.
Exactly. And honestly, like, to bring it back to Michael Johnson, like, Clay Guida is in the same boat.
Yeah.
Good, but it's like, but what's he going to do against a Beneil Dariush or a, you know, or the other guys who Dariush is scheduled underneath, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like, it's those three, you know, 155 heavyweight and 135, well, low. You know what I mean? Because, like, what's Overeem hold do against Ngannou? Or, you know, we saw what Rozenstruik did to him. And, you know, it's like all of these guys are savages, and Overeem just can't hold up to them anymore.
100%. I mean, the guy's got easily over maybe 100 combat sport fights, and he's been fighting since he was essentially a kid. I mean, we saw him fight through Pride, through Strikeforce. We've seen him in Dream. We've seen him in K1 and now in the UFC. And he's been in the UFC for a long ass time. I would say maybe six years or so he's been in the UFC fighting top competition. So I think you just reach a point where it's it comes a time where you have to just hang up the gloves. And I think that maybe Overeem might take, I think he seems like a very prideful guy. I think he might take one more of these kind of gimme fights and hang it up, and I think that that's the end of it.
Yeah, and honestly, too, it's like, it's hard to find somebody with Overeem.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I mean, even compared to a guy like Frankie Edgar, Alistair Overeem has a tremendous resume. You know, he is an all-time great. He's done just about everything he can in the sport. And sure, I know he wants, like, the UFC belt, but he also had the other belts at a time when the UFC belt didn't mean as much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so it's like, so I get it. But, like, you know, again, too, especially, like, he was never the young guy when he was in the UFC.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, because his first fight in the UFC was against Lesnar, right?
Was, yeah.
And so I think that, and I think that was like 8 years ago.
Oh, okay.
That was before. Yeah. Because that was before Lesnar initially rode off into the sunset. As I think, because I remember Lesnar had the fight with Kane, and then he had the fight with Alistair.
Yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, he's 40 years old, and his UFC debut was, 9 years ago, 30th December 2011. So he's been in the UFC for a long ass time. And look at all the guys he's fought, from Lesnar to Frank Mir to Dos Santos to Miocic to Mark Hunt to Ngannou to Verdum. Like, he's fought everybody. And I think you just reach a point where, especially at 40 and as a heavyweight, you take a lot of punishment. So it's time for him to hang it up for sure.
100%. And it's like, I'm sure it's incredibly difficult for a guy who, especially if your identity is so wrapped up in being a professional fighter, to then hang it up. And when we see it in other sports too, it just is often far less detrimental in other sports than it can be in fighting. But I think now it's time for him to have that conversation.
100%, man. And I think, like you said, or like we mentioned earlier, there's going to be a lot of roster cuts, and they're looking to really slim down the divisions and the roster as a whole. So I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of try to push Overeem into retirement, you know, the Dana White way, where he just kind of goes in an interview and says, you know, I think these guys should hang it up, and I don't really like seeing these guys take too much punishment. I think it's kind of going to be like a silent, we'll give you one more fight and that's it, right off into the sunset deal.
Exactly. Maybe try to give him a win and then let him go.
Exactly. I guess maybe to wrap it up, what do you feel about next week's main event? It's Kamaru Usman versus Gilbert Burns.
I'm going to play it safe and pick Usman. Yeah. Because he's shown he's willing to do whatever it takes to win. You know, it's like, you know, because I always find I have an easier time about betting on the guys who don't mind if the fight is boring. You know, because that means he's just going to do what he can to win. He's not going to try and, you know, go crazy just to appease the fans or anything like that. Like, he has no problem just putting you on your ass and keeping you there the whole time. So I'm going with Usman.
Yeah, I think Usman's a safe bet. I was thinking about it earlier too, and I feel like I'm always like betting against Usman for some reason. I thought he would win the Colby fight.
Yep.
And I thought he would take the belt from Tyron Woodley. But in the Masvidal fight, I kind of had this feeling that maybe Masvidal could go in there and beat him. But I don't know why I keep doing this to myself. I've done it with Conor earlier in his career, and Tyron is a beast. I just think it's going to be real interesting to see how the fight plays off on the feet. I do think that Burns is the better striker and does have more power. And I guess the question is, if Usman takes the fight down to the ground, how well does Gilbert Burns's jiu-jitsu fare against the control that Usman has, right? And his overpower, like, stature. He's a huge guy. So
what I'm predicting is that I'm predicting Usman tries to do the old GSP strategy of push him into the fence and largely keep him there, rather than necessarily even committing to going for a takedown. Get him against the fence, pepper him with like knees and short punches just to kind of soften him up. And then maybe towards the end of the round, you hit a takedown to take away Gilbert's ability to really get anything going.
Yeah, let's see. I think this is kind of like an anything can happen fight. I'm going to lean a little bit more towards Usman, but I could obviously see Burns taking the fight as well. Like you just highlighted his path to victory. I think Burns's would be to kind of keep the distance and just be in and out with his strikes and try to land big punches and volume and just avoid being taken down at all costs.
I agree completely.
Yeah, awesome, man. It was great recapping the fights with you. I hope you guys enjoyed this week's episode of the 10-Year Blue Belt Podcast, and we'll tune in again next week. Cheers, guys. Bye.